All lines are now bridged.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Thank you. Hello and good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Trust Exchange Framework Task Force. We will call the meeting to order, starting with a roll call. Denise Webb.
Present.
Arian Malik.
Hello.
Carolyn Peterson.
Present.
Aaron Mary. Is Aaron on yet? We'll circle back. John Kansky. Is John on? Cheryl Turney. Sasha Termock.
Present.
Steve Reedy.
Present.
Cynthia Fisher. Not yet. Anil Jain. Do you have Anil? Kate Goodrich. Kate. Andy Truscott. No Andy. David McCallie.
Here.
Mark Savage.
Here, thanks.
Noam Arts.
I'm here.
And Grace Terrell.
Here.
All righty, just enough for a quorum. I'll hand it over to Denise and Arian.
Yes, hi,
great.
This is Cheryl Turney, and I'm on also.
Oh, hi, Cheryl.
Kansky's here, too.
Great, thank you, guys.
Anil's waiting for the conference line.
Okay.
Via chat.
I'm on now. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
So we have more than a quorum. So we've gotten a lot of really helpful feedback so far on the draft recommendations. A lot of really good substantive comment, which is why the draft recommendations were draft. We're going to have to do a few rapid turns of the discussion. As you saw, based on the last meeting, we did a fairly rapid turn of editorial changes. We've gotten some more feedback inbound, and we're likely to do probably a couple more, a few more turns before it comes time to submit the final recommendations. I really appreciate the level of rigor and attention people have paid to the recommendations. And to the substantive comments people have made so far, we have a lot of work to do this week in order to prepare for the final presentation for next week. Unless Denise objects, I think it would be best to go to the place we stopped last time and just go through the detailed review of requirements or of recommendations go through the same process and try to do one pass through the whole document before we go back and address some of the changes that we've made or some of the other suggestions that have come inbound. Denise, if you've got other alternatives or other approaches, I'm certainly happy to.
No, I'm good.
Go
with
along
that.
With that. Yeah. All right.
I agree. That's.
Arian, can I jump in with a quick question?
Sure.
How important is it to get feedback back to you guys in writing, sort of interlineating in the draft compared to the phone calls? I haven't sent anything in writing. I'm just listening to you. I'm wondering if I should be erring on the side of getting it in writing too, rather than in addition to participating on the phone calls.
I think it is helpful to do both. I'd also say that just given the time frame, there's only so much input that we can reasonably take in.
Yep.
Hopefully you've seen that the drafting that we did after the last meeting addressed many of the verbal comments. So I don't think there's any need to repeat comments followed up in writing if you've already made them verbally in the task force. Clearly, if you feel on reading the edits that you've got something that you feel very strongly about that hasn't been addressed, feel free to follow up in writing. At the end of the day, we're trying to create consensus-based requirements, which means there may be some areas that one person or another feels very strongly about, but may not make it into the final draft. In other cases, there may be something that people feel very strongly about that we can make some appropriate tweaks to the language to address. But I'd say try to make them verbally here. we'll make sure that we accommodate them in the draft. We'll try to make sure that we flip drafts quickly. And as you, if you find something that you feel very strongly about that we haven't addressed, please make a comment via email as quickly as possible so we can address it.
Thanks much.
All right, I think we were most of the way through the REC language, if I remember last time.
Yeah, we stopped on the recommendation that started with ONC should require the RCE as it works on standards, implementation guidance profiles, and other enabling material to make such material open to the public without restrictions. And I think we ended with that recommendation and that we were stopped there. And we're about to go into the prelude to the next recommendation.
Thank you for that. So if we go down a couple more pages.
And Erin, this is Lauren. For those that are viewing the document on Adobe, there is a way to expand that main window. I know it's a little bit hard to see. The font is a little small.
That little arrow that looks like it means compress everything, but actually means expand everything. It's right next to the stop sharing window, if you have that, or to the left of the pod options, if you have that as well. Interview me. Yeah.
It's David. Before we jump into the new stuff, on the RCE page, the bottom of page 6, when I was looking over it, I had a couple of...
Can you go back up one to the bottom of page 6? Perfect. Yep.
And they were just questions. The first one is in the recommendation paragraph in the middle there. It says the RCE should represent a broad range of provider perspectives. Do we want to include a broader range than just providers? Would payers and aggregators like registries also merit inclusion there, or is your sense of the word provider include that?
It would not include that. So I think it's something we should discuss. The logic behind this and the logic behind my understanding of the discussion that we had on this is that the 21st Century Cures obligations in the legislative text are on provider organizations. There are other stakeholders who are interested stakeholders, but don't have the same information blocking obligations placed on them. So on the other hand, serving a range of health information stakeholders, including public health and payers, generally is a good thing. And then on the third hand, then I'm obviously running out of hands. If you build a governance structure that includes everybody in healthcare, you end up building an unmanageable governance structure. So,
this is Sasha, but could we maybe talk about that at a higher level? Because I saw in several of the recommendations the kind of, I guess, underlying assumption that providers must participate in the trusted exchange framework or they would be considered information blocking. But that isn't something that we've had a lot of opportunity to discuss. And I guess my feeling was more that the trusted exchange framework should be, you know, such a competitive offering as far as exchange that people would voluntarily participate and it wouldn't be an obligation if there were other sufficient methods to exchange.
I just saw your comments come in.
Yeah. No, and they were just before the meeting. So
Hopefully I didn't say anywhere in the document, or hopefully the current draft of the document does not say anywhere in it any implication that participation in a QHIN or the TEF would be a requirement. Number one, the ONC has yet to put out even draft regulatory enablement for any of the information blocking provisions under 21st Century Cures. Number two, I think, Sasha, as you noted in your email, the TEF is supposed to be a voluntary set of activities, and in many ways, ONC, because it's voluntary, is able to use a different set of regulatory or non-regulatory tools than ONC would if it were a non-voluntary activity. That being said, and we can take this out, but that being said, I think a number of commenters have presumed that and maybe read between the lines in the 21st Century Cures language, have presumed that there's an implied, if not an implied safe harbor, at least an implied presumption that you're doing the right thing if you're participating via through a QHIN via the TEF with regard to information blocking. And again, if people feel like that's too far a line to step, I'm quite happy to.
I feel like it's
Yeah. Kind
of a responsibility on us to make the trusted exchange framework on us and the TEP, the RCE and ONC and the QHINs, but to make the trusted exchange framework a viable option that people would see it as the best way to exchange
mm-hmm.
information. And I actually kind of feel like it will be a distorting factor if there are other regulatory penalties that make it kind of seen as the only way. I don't know, that sort of messes with some of the other assumptions we've made
yeah.
about, like, how would we measure success? If you say you have to participate in this, and then we say it's successful because everyone participated, we've kind of, I think we need different success metrics if that's the underlying assumption. So I guess I'd
yeah.
like to clarify that we have a voluntary participation underlying assumption. And we could still say here that we think provider stakeholders are maybe worthy of a special call out in RCE governance. But I think I would propose, I guess, to the group that we underline that we're framing all of our assumptions around the expectation that it is voluntary to participate.
So I'm seeing a lot of hands up. This is a really important topic to discuss. We'll go to Noam, Anil, Mark, and David. David so quickly put his hand up.
I'll pass for now. My comment isn't about this point, and I don't
okay.
want to disrupt the conversation, but please come back to me.
Will do. Anil?
Yeah, I think my comment has to do with some of your, you know, there is a line blurring between providers and payers. And I think if you think about why we're all doing this, it's to handle some of the biggest challenges around value-based care and population health. And so rather than, and I heard some verbiage about, you know, sort of focusing on the provider and singling out the provider when it comes to information blocking, I think it's really anyone that is participating in some sort of accountable care. And so as providers take on risk, they are in some ways becoming the plan or becoming the payer. And payers who are now aggregated provider relationships in an ACO structure are taking that on as well. So I don't have the best language in how to represent that, but I think we're missing something if we just focus on the provider in the context of what we just discussed.
So, Anil, the only counterpoint that I would have to that and just interested in your thoughts is that if you read the 21st Century Cures Act, it is very clear that the only two entities that are subject to information blocking penalties are HIT vendors and providers.
Mm-hmm.
And so a payer could choose to keep data to refuse to share data for a variety of purposes and suffer no penalties associated
right.
with those activities, whereas a provider or a health IT vendor is subject to penalties under 21st Century Cures. So
understood.
To some extent, they've got a bigger interest in, they got more skin in the game to making sure that there's at least ready-made pathways for information exchange.
Understood. I do think that I see providers having relations with payers where the payers themselves are the HIT vendor deployment vehicle or the ones who are actually supplying the technical solutions. So they're creating relationships to extend, for example, the large EHR vendors or committee-based EHR vendors to these ACOs, that we not lose sight of the fact that in any kind of population health or value-based care, simply having the EMR vendor and the provider have free flow of information across the provider, put that in quotes, provider ecosystem isn't going to be enough to actually solve
yep.
the problem we're trying to solve here.
No, I completely agree with that, and it's a great point. Mark?
I'm going to go back to the starting point for this thread about sort of how broadly to define participation, just providers and patients. I'd say that I hear you, Aaron, that 21st Century Cures talks about information blocking in some contexts of users, but looking at it positively, affirmatively, the trusted exchange framework is supposed to serve a broader range of stakeholders. And I think that's where we ought to think about this more as coalition building, getting the essential people to the table, letting them know that they have something to contribute because they are users, stakeholders, and I think we should use that broader range. So I'd look at the users that are mentioned in the draft and in the user guide and think of it that way. On the question about voluntary, I know that generally it's that, but I just want to also note that there's a provision in CURES which says that federal agencies can require the use of it. So I just throw that out there to make sure that we have that in mind as we're talking, that we're not saying anything here that actually suggests that we're going against what 21st Century Cures is saying, although we can make sense to frame this as our thinking about it as a voluntary structure.
I'm going to defer to ONC on this, but my understanding is that if a federal agency made an activity non-voluntary and required for participation, they would typically have to do that through a contract or through rulemaking as opposed to through broad obligations on provider organizations.
And that's what 21st Century Cures says
yeah.
Contracts.
Yep. David.
I think that, you know, this conversation would make a lot more sense if we had the data blocking rule available so that we could tie the two together. And, you know, so in some sense, ideally, we could come back and revisit this at some point after we have the data blocking rule. But we don't. So, you know, given that we have to operate under the assumption that we don't know what the connection between the TEFCA and data blocking is, I would propose maybe that the concept here be stakeholders associated with the permitted purposes, which is to
That's
say
fair.
If the permitted purposes are narrow, the stakeholders are a narrower group, but if the permitted purposes and use cases, to use their language, are broader, then the stakeholders would be broader. For example, there's no mention of consumer input or of
public health. Well, there definitely is, or there should be, and apologies if there isn't, there definitely is a note that the governance should include the patient perspective, if by consumer you mean consumer apps and the like.
I meant, patient is probably close enough.
Yeah, so patient, providers and patients are explicitly called out. How do people feel about David's suggested amendment, which I find kind of elegant, rather than define?
This is Mark.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I think it makes sense at an operational level, but we're talking about as I understand it, the issue is governance, and so I think at a governance level, you don't have sort of a sliding scale depending on how narrow or broad the permitted purpose is. You include the key groups for representation, so they're available. So I for example, we're doing a lot of stuff with apps, tech innovators. So it seems like technology developers and payers ought to be, and public health ought to be mentioned as well.
Well, and that was my point, that to the degree that there's a clarification around the permitted purposes during the first 3 years of the RCE's funding by ONC, the appropriate stakeholders should be represented in the RCE. We don't quite know what that list is. I mean, we've proposed a narrowing of the focus from the broad list of everything you could do with a single on-ramp. I'm suggesting stakeholders that reflect the permitted purposes that are and use cases that are expected during the first 3 years. Should be represented. Admittedly, it's deferring a little bit, but connecting it to the goals.
So the other way of managing this is, we could stay, we could also talk about broad range of perspectives. So the concerns that were reflected in this recommendation were the concerns that when you form, historically, when governance organizations have been formed, they tend to oversample from particular areas. And particularly when you look at representation for provider organizations, it tends to be the largest provider organizations that have the institutional means to participate. And unless you guard against that oversampling, you tend to get overrepresentation. I'm also a little worried about making recommendations that effectively require ungovernable governance, because you've got so many stakeholder perspectives that are represented on a governance structure. And I understand there are different governance structures that may be not the same as a board structure, but you're basically asking the RCE to do so much and adjudicate so much that the organization becomes effectively ungovernable.
But Arian, my point is, though, if you expect participation from a particular segment of the industry and they have no representation, the participation is going to be unlikely.
I like, David, your formulation, but I'm not hearing a lot of broad agreement for the formulation. What I'd recommend is that we keep moving.
Could you repeat what he said?
Yeah. So David's recommendation is that the stakeholders who share obligations under permitted purposes for the TEF be the ones represented in the governance in the RCE.
And it could be, if this is David, it could be maybe better structured away from the permitted purpose angle and just say stakeholders drawn from groups expected to participate in the exchange of data using the TEF. Whatever the permitted purpose is. So in other words, if there are no, I'll just say, if there are no payer exchanges contemplated, if at some point it just doesn't appear that that's where it's going to go, then that group doesn't need the representation. On the other hand, if payers are expected to play a large role in exchange of data using the use cases around population health queries, then they should be a part of the governance. So stakeholders reflecting actual use of the network.
I'm going to suggest just in the interest of time that we try to do a breadth first search first, and note that there is some cleanup of this language that is desired, and that we try to collect alternatives to this. And at the end, if we can't get an agreed on alternative, we can get fuzzier, because you can always get fuzzier. Let's go to the next slide, the next page.
I'm sorry, Arian, if we could just come back to where I started.
Oh, sure, please. Apologies. Yeah, go for it.
And so if you could go back a page. And I think actually it in the end it becomes relevant to the conversation we just had. I'll try to make this point quickly. I'm concerned about the little two-line paragraph a smack in the middle of this page, which talks about, it says the task force believes the likely sustainability model for the RCE is through dues, and then there's essentially a governance comment about oversight. So I'll say two things. First, just like we think it's presumptuous to recommend within any of these documents a particular technical architecture or standard, I believe it is also presumptuous to say that we believe that any particular sustainability model is what will or should happen, because in fact it's up to the RCEs to propose something. So I would suggest that in fact we strike these two lines entirely. I don't think it takes away from anything we're trying to say. To link to the previous point, I'm therefore confused about this whole conversation about governance of the RCE, governance within the RCE. So here these two lines seem to say that it's the paying members who have oversight role. Is that a gloss for governance? I don't know. And yet we were talking just before, well, no, it's the impacted stakeholders who have some governance. So I find all of this confusing and in some ways perhaps conflicting.
Yep. So just a one key point. So Noam, I got your I think we got your comments via email. I agree with you that at this stage it's probably inappropriate for us to say that the sustainability model is through X. So I have no issues with striking that. That did come out of task force discussion. I do think there's a general principle, and the oversight role is fiduciary oversight. I think there's a general principle that the organizations that are paying dues to an organization should have at least some say in how the money is spent. So that's the only commentary there, is that clause is intended to be, is and is intended to be restricted to fiduciary oversight,
making sure that
organizations aren't contributing money and then having money spent in ways that they don't agree with. Bad governance.
Except that just because organizations are, quote, paying doesn't mean that it's, quote, dues. So, in fact, I could see an RCE that requires payment, but that payment isn't dues and doesn't bring up fiduciary responsibility.
It's totally fair, and I completely agree that we should not assume that the governance of the RCE will be structured in any one particular way. All right, I'd recommend that we keep going. We got through the recommendation on standards implementation guidance profiles as open, and we didn't see any comment on that. So let's try to keep going and spend the next half hour getting through a good chunk of, in a breadth-first search, a good chunk of the information available in front of us.
Arian, this is Noam. I had sent you a comment within that section as well, right? And someone made earlier reference this whole notion of judging the RCE primarily based on outcomes that it may or may not be able to control. I don't know that I agree with that. I don't know that I don't, but I don't know that I do.
Noam, we talked about in the beginning of the meeting a desire to get through these recommendations, going through the full set of recommendations first, and then coming back and looping back to information that we've already covered. So just in the interest of time, I'd like us to be able to stick to that. We will have ample opportunity for people to come back and re-comment on the revised language for after we've gotten through the full document.
Okay, sorry.
Nope, thanks. All right, next page. There we go. Oh, and sorry, Noam, you're right. This is this is actually the recommendation that we're commenting on. So the task force did discuss how we should judge the success or failure of the RCE, and it was at least my understanding of the belief of the task force that we should judge the RCE primarily on outcomes-based measures and the real-world success of interoperability enabled by the RCE's activities. Secondarily through process measures, including satisfaction, secondarily through satisfaction measures and process-based measures should be viewed as leading indicators. So we also noted that the effort, outcome, satisfaction, and process measures should be defined with the end in mind at working backwards to satisfy the twin constraints of realism and policy urgency. So the recommendation here is ONC should develop a set of outcome-based measures and associated milestones based on the expected patient and provider real-world experiences enabled through the TEF and associated RCE activities. The RCE should define a set of satisfaction, user experience, and process measures and metrics linked to the outcomes measures. Measures and milestones should be defined from the perspective of the desired real-world goals executed to be achieved by the end of year three, then work backwards to interim goals balancing realism and urgency. Outcomes, measures, and milestones should be set based on high-priority use cases and forward reference to the task force recommendations on permitted uses. So at this point, sorry, Noam. I think Noam does want to be in the queue. But we've got Mark, Noam, and John as in the queue to comment on this recommendation. Mark, go ahead.
So this is a comment here, but at some other places too. Because the word realism, because we're trying to push the envelope, I worry that that holds us back a little bit and want to suggest feasibility instead of realism.
That's fine.
And want to, I understand the focus on year three, but I think any strategic governance entity is going to be looking beyond year three as it's trying to stack up what's the best way to do things. So I would perhaps, what occurred to me is from the perspective of the policy imperatives and real world goals, recognizing that not all might be achieved by the end of year three.
So my understanding is the way this comment was framed was around the milestones for the first 3 years, keeping in mind that that's the time frame and contemplated in the TEF at which the RCE would be reselected. Maybe I'll go to Zoe for to make sure like we got that right. That was the thought process behind 3 years. Yeah.
That is correct. Yeah.
So maybe there is some thinking when we have more time to be done between whether to use goals or milestones there. Is it the milestones that are expected to be achieved by the end of year three rather than the goals?
That's fair. So there should be some level of forward-looking approach. But I do think the language here was noted that you would judge the success, and mindful of Noam's dissent here, the notion is that you would judge the success of the RCE at that three-year period, not just mm-hmm. on meeting process measures and secondary milestones,
correct.
But also what was happening at the end of that three-year period.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you. So next in the queue is Noam. Then we have John and Anil.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess I've sort of said what I had to say mostly. So I am concerned. So we're in a section about the RCE. So for instance, as I look at the very last line of this recommendation smack in the middle of the page, the outcome measures and milestones, though it doesn't say it explicitly in this sentence, are of the RCE, right? Not of trust and exchange, right? I just want to make sure that I'm reading this the way that you intended it.
Yes, yes, you are. So the thought process here, which I believe, and again, if the task force generally believes very differently, the thought process that's leading to this language is that if we had an RCE that hit all of its process milestones, but we weren't seeing real world interoperability, there could be a variety of reasons for that failure, but you wouldn't tend to judge the RCE as being, incredibly successful at that stage. And again, very mindful that there may be other contributing factors to failure to achieve real world interoperability. It does seem appropriate to tie the RCE to the national outcome as opposed to tying the RCE to process-based measures that they can meet without meeting the national outcome. That's at least the way I understood the conversation of the task force. Why don't we go to Anil?
The only thing I'd add is it seems to me like we're setting up the RCE to hold the bag. And that's all that I'll say. Something goes south, so all the RCE's fall.
All right, John?
Sure, I'll try to be brief. So it's clearly the easiest thing for us to recommend that outcomes measures are used to measure the RCE success because that sounds right. As somebody who's been forced to think long and hard about what an outcomes measure is for health information exchange by one's board, I can tell you that it's really hard to define outcomes measures for health information exchange that, as someone mentioned earlier, can legitimately be attributed to the RCE, depending on maybe someone has an example for me. But if you go so far as to say outcomes measures like reduced readmissions or reduced repeat tests, there's so many variables between the RCE and that outcome, as that's not a really a good measure. If you start counting transactions that the RCE has enabled, I think that's a process measure.
Okay, that's completely fair. And this may just be drafting issues. When in the discussion that led to this drafting, I believe the discussion of outcome was associated with the real-world exchange activities. So you might consider from a health outcomes perspective that to be a process measure. From an RCE perspective, that's an outcome measure. So if providers and if participants in exchange are actually exchanging information, that would be the level of RCE success criteria that would be contemplated. I agree that there's a set of health outcomes that are associated with that that could be very well beyond the ability of the RCE to achieve.
So maybe we just need another sentence or two to make that recommendation clear.
Cool. Thank you. It's super useful feedback. Mark?
I'm just going to put it in the comment. The National Quality Forum's Interoperability Measurement Framework talks about outcomes. So not the only source, but we do have some work that's already been done by the range of stakeholders.
Relating to exchange activities or relating to the
interoperability.
Okay.
Which includes exchange.
Yeah.
Yep.
So we should be explicit. We're talking about measures of interoperability, not measures of clinical outcomes associated with interoperability.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Let's go on to qualified health information networks. So we spent a good amount of time discussing the notion of participant neutral, we discussed in our general overarching comments that we desire ONC to be more explicit about policy goals. We have a specific recommendation relating to participant neutral. So number one, ONC should clarify the policy intent and the meaning of participant neutral and revise the definition associated qualification criteria for QHINs to better reflect the policy intent. ONC should define a policy goal that the overall ecosystem of QHINs is neutral and accessible to all parties. ONC should use more neutral definitions that do not prevent data holders from offering QHIN services. And if ONC desires stronger, more restrictive participant neutral language, ONC should continue the various ways the prospective QHINs may structure business entities to address possible restrictions. So that last sentence is related to the comment that it's generally feasible to take one business entity and structure it differently so that sub-business entities or not-for-profit entities that use services end up being the business entity that's associated with the exchange activity. And in particular, the sort of commentary around this noted that many of the real-world exchanges that people associate or attribute to a specific vendor are in fact not-for-profit organizations that are governed and managed by provider organizations that use a particular health information technology or set of exchange services. So, thoughts, comments on this recommendation? And I will go back to I'm going back and forth between screen sharing and looking at the participant list. I don't see anybody whose hand is up. Does that indicate Sasha's hand is up? Anybody else? Okay, we'll go to Sasha.
Thanks, Arian. And I think the recommendation is well stated and reflects the conversation. I emailed this, so maybe folks will have a chance to look offline also, but the preamble language here about speculating about why ONC did this, I guess I'd vote to just take that out of our letter.
Fair.
We didn't get that specifically from ONC, and I don't know that it is agreed upon by everyone, and it probably doesn't need to be there.
Which
totally
Senate
fair.
Are you referring to, Tasha? Which Senate?
The paragraph that
speculate the intent.
Speculate the intent.
So you want to strike that?
This is the
is
the royal we in this case, so apologies for that.
I don't think we need that paragraph, and I think we could just take it out and go to the next part about we want ONC to clarify the underlying policy goals, and that leads into our recommendation about policy intent.
Completely fair.
Which paragraph are we talking about striking? I'm still not clear.
The paragraph on the top of page 8 that starts, we speculate the intent of the language is to ensure.
Okay, just that paragraph.
Just that paragraph.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. We got Mark and John in the queue.
So this is more conceptual because I don't have an answer, but the sentence that says, let the RCE and QHANs work out the operational details on the broker model, I think that seems right from sort of a general operational perspective. At the same time, I worry about how long that could take if we need to move quickly, and I want to lift up the possible delay and timing issues.
Yep.
And I don't have any answers, but I just lift that up as something for us to be thinking about.
So just to be clear, this is the next recommendation. So we'll get there in just a second. But you know, maybe we want to talk about clear timeframes associated with that.
Okay. Sorry, I missed.
No problem.
The break. Thank you.
John.
Real quick, just trying to follow along with the editing as we referring to how we tee this up with the taking out of that project, the paragraph on speculation, which I think I agree with. My concern was that when we stated, by the way, which is something I violently agree with, when we stated that, hey, we didn't really understand why ONC wanted to limit who could be a QHIN, I think they perceive that they have answered that question. And so I didn't want us to imply in a way that was confusing to ONC that, no, you haven't, because it's more that we haven't understood the answer, if that's fair.
Yeah, I'd also note that if you look at the way this is defined, the definition of participant neutral is literally in the definition section. It's fair to say we didn't understand the answer. I think in this case it's also fair to say it's not clear that there was a lot of language around it just because of where it occurred.
So as long as the way that it's written reflects that, I just wanted to say that out loud.
That's totally fair.
But Arian, David,
your hand's in the queue and you're making your comment.
Good. That's why I raised it, after the fact raising. We're both asking for increased clarity around participant neutral, but aren't we also suggesting considering a broader range of choices than what it appears they intended to communicate? So
the recommendation here is, number one, sub-recommendation one is ONC should clarify the policy intent and revise the definition associated qualification QHINs to better reflect the policy intent. Number two, ONC should define a policy goal that the overall ecosystem of QHINs is neutral and accessible to all parties,
right?
Which I think reflects the commentary that we had around that. Number three, ONC should use more neutral definitions that do not prevent data holders from offering QHIN services. And number four, just a note that if they want something stronger, ONC should consider the various ways that business units might be structured to address. Is there something you think is missing from those four sub-recommendations? I think the drafting intent was that The third effectively bullet here, ONC should use more neutral definitions that do not prevent data holders from offering QM services, was intended to address that this may be over-rotated on a particular solution rather than addressing the policy goal.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that we're not talking merely about clarification. We had opinions about what participant neutral could mean, and that we should capture those.
Yeah, so I believe the opinion here is captured in the mix of the second and the third bullet, and if it's not, I think we're absolutely open for additional drafting to reflect the task force's perspective here.
Okay. And I'll take a look at it when we get the final, when we get the next version of edits and see
yep.
if I feel comfortable with it. I'm a little out, my version is a little out of sync with yours, so.
Okay. I don't think anybody else's hand is in the queue. Good. All right. Next is ONC should define, so this is separating the definition of the broker model from the TEF itself. Generally consistent with our recommendations that ONC defined functional requirements, specifically for the broker model, we believe that ONC should define functional requirements and let the RCE and QHINs work it out. I think it was John who commented that we should define clear and urgent milestones to that working it out, so not open-ended 3-year-long working it out. So I think we need to make that editorial comment, but the recommendations here is ONC should define a set of functional requirements, document the outcomes of using a QHIN from the perspective of a provider or patient. For example, ONC might define a functional requirement that a provider or patient should receive all known locations where a patient's data might be found and the content of data to be found at those locations, regardless of the technology vendor or QHIN used by the end location of data. So I'm going to pause there and see if that recommendation appropriately addresses the task force's perspectives here. I see David with his hand up. I'll wait 2 beats. Go, David.
I think that recommendation does capture it if you kind of know what we talked about. I'm not sure a naive reader would understand that, so I might argue for a slightly more explicit example of a potential functional requirement. I submitted some possible thoughts in the email I sent you guys yesterday, but I'd be happy to walk through them. I mean, it's just being a little bit more concrete. I think you captured the truth there. It's just subtext almost.
Yeah. So without objection, I'll look at David's, we'll look at David's comments and see if we can insert them in appropriately. And then we'll definitely go back to the full task force to make sure that we've captured the intent of the task force appropriately.
And
no
I'm
objection.
Happy to revise them if we didn't. I just was whipping off some examples
yep.
of something that was slightly more explicit.
Yep.
And again, to be taken just as example, not, you know, anything other than think about it this way.
Okay. Now the easy topic of fees.
So, Arianna, do you think we have to pause for public comment?
Okay. Let's do that.
Operator, can we please open the line?
Thank you. If you would like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys.
Thank you. And do we have any comments in the queue at this time?
There are no comments in the queue at this time.
Okay, thank you. Hand it back to Arian.
All right. Fees, the simple topic of fees. Can we go back to the document?
Arian?
All right. Yep.
I have a prolegomena question about fees. Would you mind explaining what you mean by common carrier requirements? Because you referenced that numerous times without ever defining what it means.
Sure. So, yeah, common carrier is definitely a term of art in effectively network neutrality spaces. The simplest analogy is that we establish a highway system, but with respect to, you know, and that highway system may have restrictions on, for example, weight or load that might be carried on the highway system, but doesn't restrict the kinds of commercial activities that take place on the road or highway. So you couldn't establish in a common carrier approach that a particular kind of commerce has one cost to use the roadway system and another kind of commerce has a different cost to use the roadway system, and, you know, individual traffic has a third fee structure to use the system. We have a system where everybody can use it. In the internet space, there's been obviously a robust and vigorous debate about whether common carrier requirements should be applied to ISPs and other people who are carrying traffic, and in particular, whether Netflix, which bears the bill for bandwidth on its end, should also bear the bill for bandwidth on the consumer end, such that there's a varying level of quality of service and associated pricing associated with carrying particular kinds of traffic on the network. With regard to the definition in the TEFCA, the net of the pricing rules establish that, number one, RCEs have QHINs have a duty and obligation to respond for permitted purposes under the TEF, and number two, any fee structures they have to be cost-based and not activity-based. And the net of those creates effectively common carrier-like requirements. So that's the background for the shorthand of common carrier.
But it specifically calls out different fee structures for different use cases, no charge for individual access, et cetera. So it struck me as not being common carrier.
Okay.
I'm not sure it adds to the...
Okay, that's fine.
It may be one of those terms that people read in too many things.
That's fine. I think in particular the intent here was to note that there are cases where right now there are participants who pay for access who under the TEF and under the set of permitted purposes would no longer have to or be able to, the QHINs would no longer be able to charge for those forms of access. And some of the examples that are provided here are payers who request data and chart abstraction for HEDIS measurement or for risk adjustment. Oftentimes payers are willing to pay for access. SSA is famously willing to pay for electronic access for adjudication, and under the rules established here, the QHIN would no longer be able to charge for that access except on a cost plus basis.
Yep.
So super happy to avoid the term common carrier and just describe it more functionally.
Yeah. I think that might help us, although it doesn't make the problem any easier.
No, that's fine. Sasha, you have a hand up.
Yeah, so just because I think this is a really complicated area, and I was maybe trying to digest it the same way David did. So there's two types of fees mentioned in the TEF, as I understand it. One is about how QHINs might charge for their services. So, for example, if a network charged its participants a participation fee, and the other is how QHINs might charge each other, which is the one that's restricted to being cost-based specifically. Both of those are applied to the QHIN fees. Would a model between endpoints still not be able to have monetary compensation? I guess I'm asking a question. If SSA isn't an endpoint but participates through a QHIN, and a provider organization is an endpoint and participates through a QHIN, is the compensation SSA might offer the provider organization for that exchange even relevant to these provisions about what QHINs can and can't charge?
That's a really good question. I think and this may not have been commentary in the task force, and I apologize if it was not commentary in the task force. Some of the commentary that I have participated in and seen on this topic notes that, and I'll pick on SSA because I think SSA is the least likely to do activities like this, but we'll pick on SSA deliberately. If SSA established if there were a federal QHIN, for example, a QHIN that was attached to federal participants, that QHIN might establish a zero-based cost structure with SSA, and SSA could ask for data for disability determination through its local QHIN, could make requests to provider organizations, and those provider organizations would be obligated to respond independent of fee structure because it's a permitted purpose, and the QHIN would be obligated to respond for that case, for that permitted purposes, purpose, and based on the cost plus language, would be limited in what they charge. If you look at real world activities for SSA, oftentimes SSA desires to mediate through exchange participants rather than contract directly with the provider organization, and they're perfectly happy to pay for an exchange participant who then splits the fee with the provider organization. So that's the thought process that led into some of this discussion.
Okay, that's helpful. So are we making a recommendation here about how QHINs charge their participants, about how QHINs charge each other, or both?
Yeah, so this may be this is a super complicated area, and we don't have much time to discuss. So we probably should start the next discussion talking about this. Some of the thought process that goes into this is that there's an overlap between 21st Century Cures obligations on provider organizations for information blocking and the fee structure requirements in the TEF that overlap in interesting and complicated ways. So if you read the 21st Century Cures, and if ONC through rulemaking establishes an interpretation of 21st Century Cures that obligates providers to respond in all cases for permitted purposes, then you get to a world very quickly where the combination of that duty to respond and the fee structure language on QHINs pushes the cost for a variety of purposes that currently are being paid for by the end actors who are getting the data onto the providers who are supplying the data. And the SSA case kind of worked out that we just did is one of those risk adjudication, and HEDIS measurement on payers is another one where you could end up flipping the market for fee structures if you don't align the fee language and the duty to respond language or the information blocking language in the right way. It's complicated, and I realize this may be my thought process and not the thought process of the task force. So I just want, maybe I'll better gloss this, work out this example, and then we can discuss it and make recommendations as a task force on the next task force call.
Go ahead.
Erin, I know you've mentioned a few times the information blocking provisions about providers and HIT developers. There's also a provision around health information networks, which is, of course, broadly defined by the Trusted Exchange Framework. Might be worth thinking about how that would also influence.
Yep. And let's talk about it next time. John, I see your hand is up. But we are out of time, so when we get to next the Friday call, we'll have ample time to address these issues.
Well, and I'll endeavor to put my thought in email before I forget it.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Noam asked for a clarification on the meeting schedule for next week, Arian. He needed an email. Never mind. Someone needs to send it to him an email.
Okay.
He's offline.
Okay.
Maybe Lauren can help there.
Yep.
Sure. Okay.
Thanks, all.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks.